Chapter 15. Would you take $1 million for what you have? I have known Harold Abbott for years. He lived in Webb City, Missouri. He used to be my lecture manager. One day he and I met in Kansas City and he drove me down to my farm in Belton, Missouri. During that drive, I asked him how he kept from worrying, and he told me an inspiring story I shall never forget. I used to worry a lot, he said. But one spring day, 1934, I was walking down West Doherty Street in Webb City, and I saw a sight that banished all my worries. It happened in 10 seconds. But during those 10 seconds, I learned more about how to live than I had learned in the previous 10 years. For 2 years, I'd been running a grocery store in Webb City, Harold Abbott said, as he told me the story. I had not only lost all my savings, but I had incurred debts that took me 7 years to pay back. My grocery store had been closed the previous Saturday, and now I was going to the Merchants and Miners Bank to borrow money so I could go to Kansas City to look for a job. I walked like a beaten man. I'd lost all my fight and faith. Then suddenly, coming down the street, I saw a man who had no legs. He was sitting on a little wooden platform equipped with wheels from roller skates. He propelled himself along the street with a block of wood in each hand. I met him just after he crossed the street and was starting to lift himself up a few inches over the curb to the sidewalk. As he tilted his little wooden platform to an angle, his eyes met mine. He greeted me with a grand smile. "Morning, sir. It's a fine morning, isn't it?" he said with spirit. As I stood looking at him, I realized how rich I was. I had 2 legs. I could walk. I felt ashamed of my self-pity. I said to myself, if he can be happy, cheerful, and confident without legs, I certainly can with legs. I could already feel my chest lifting. I had intended to ask the Merchants and Miners Bank for only $100, but now I had courage to ask for $200. I had intended to say that I wanted to go to Kansas City to try to get a job, but now I announced confidently that I wanted to go to Kansas City to get a job. I got the loan, and I got the job. I now have the following words pasted on my bathroom mirror, and I read them every morning as I shave. I had the blues because I had no shoes, until upon the street I met a man who had no feet. I once asked Eddie Rickenbacker what was the biggest lesson he had learned from drifting about with his companions in life rafts for 21 days, hopelessly lost in the Pacific. The biggest lesson I learned from that experience, he said, was that if you have all the fresh water you want to drink and all the food you want to eat, you ought never to complain about anything. Time ran an article about a sergeant who had been wounded on Guadalcanal. Hit in the throat by a shell fragment, this sergeant had 7 blood transfusions. Writing a note to his doctor, he asked, "Will I live?" The doctor replied, "Yes." He wrote another note asking, "Will I be able to talk?" Again, the answer was yes. Then he wrote another note saying, "Then what in the hell am I worrying about?" Why don't you stop right now and ask yourself, "What in the hell am I worrying about?" You will probably find that it is comparatively unimportant and insignificant. About 90% of the things in our lives are right, and about 10% are wrong. If we want to be happy, all we have to do is concentrate on the 90% that are right and ignore the 10% that are wrong. If we want to be worried and bitter and have stomach ulcers, all we have to do is concentrate on the 10% that are wrong and ignore the 90% that are glorious. The words think and thank are inscribed in many of the Cromwellian churches of England. These words ought to be inscribed in our hearts, too. Think and thank. Think of all we have to be grateful for, and thank God for all our boons and bounties. Jonathan Swift, author of Gulliver's Travels, was the most devastating pessimist in English literature. He was so sorry that he had been born that he wore black and fasted on his birthdays. Yet in his despair, this supreme pessimist of English literature praised the great health-giving powers of cheerfulness and happiness. The best doctors in the world, he declared, are Dr. Diet, Dr. Quiet, and Dr. Merryman. You and I may have the services of Dr. Merryman free every hour of the day by keeping our attention fixed on all the incredible riches we possess, riches exceeding by far the fabled treasures of Alibaba. Would you sell both your eyes for $1 billion? What would you take for your two legs, your hands, your hearing, your children, your family? Add up your assets, and you will find that you won't sell what you have for all the gold ever amassed by the Rockefellers, the Fords, and the Morgans combined. But do we appreciate all this? Ah, no. As Schopenhauer said, we seldom think of what we have, but always of what we lack. Yes, the tendency to seldom think of what we have, but always of what we lack, is the greatest tragedy on earth. It has probably caused more misery than all the wars and diseases in history. It caused John Palmer to turn from a regular guy into an old grouch and almost wreck his home. I know, because he told me so. Mr. Palmer lives in Paterson, New Jersey. Shortly after I returned from the Army, he said, I started in business for myself. I worked hard day and night. Things were going nicely. Then trouble started. I couldn't get parts and materials. I was afraid I would have to give up my business. I worried so much that I changed from a regular guy into an old grouch. I became so sour and cross that, well, I didn't know it then, but I now realize that I came very near to losing my happy home. Then one day, a young disabled veteran who works for me said, Johnny, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. You take on as if you were the only person in the world with troubles. Suppose you do have to shut up shop for a while. So what? You can start up again when things get normal. You've got a lot to be thankful for. Yet you're always growling. Boy, how I wish I were in your shoes. Look at me. I've only got one arm and half of my face is shot away, and yet I'm not complaining. If you don't stop your growling and grumbling, you'll lose not only your business, but also your health, your home, and your friends. Those remarks stopped me dead in my tracks. They made me realize how well off I was. I resolved then and there that I would change and be my old self again. And I did. A friend of mine, Lucille Blake, had to tremble on the edge of tragedy before she learned to be happy about what she had instead of worrying over what she lacked. I met Lucille years ago when we were both studying short story writing in the Columbia University School of Journalism. Some years ago, she got the shock of her life. She was living then in Tucson, Arizona. She had, well, and here's the story as she told it to me. I had been living in a whirl, studying the organ at the University of Arizona, conducting a speech clinic in town, and teaching a class in musical appreciation at the Desert Willow Ranch where I was staying. I was going in for parties, dances, horseback rides under the stars. One morning, I collapsed. My heart. You'll have to lie in bed for a year of complete rest, the doctor said. He didn't encourage me to believe I would ever be strong again. In bed for a year, to be an invalid, perhaps to die. I was terror-stricken. Why did all this have to happen to me? What had I done to deserve it? I wept and wailed. I was bitter and rebellious. But I did go to bed as the doctor advised. A neighbor of mine, Mr. Rudolph, an artist, said to me, You think now that spending a year in bed will be a tragedy, but it won't be. You'll have the time to think and get acquainted with yourself. You'll make more spiritual growth in these next few months than you've made during all your previous life. I became calmer and tried to develop a new sense of values. I read books of inspiration. One day I heard a radio commentator say, You can express only what is in your own consciousness. I had heard words like these many times before, but now they reached down inside me and took root. I resolved to think only the thoughts I wanted to live by, thoughts of joy, happiness, health. I forced myself each morning as soon as I awoke to go over all the things I had to be grateful for. No pain, a lovely young daughter, my eyesight, my hearing, lovely music on the radio, time to read, good food, good friends. I was so cheerful and had so many visitors that the doctor put up a sign saying that only one visitor at a time would be allowed in my cabin, and only at certain hours. Many years have passed since then, and I now lead a full, active life. I'm deeply grateful now for that year I spent in bed. It was the most valuable and the happiest year I spent in Arizona. The habit I formed then of counting my blessings each morning still remains with me. It is one of my most precious possessions. I'm ashamed to realize that I never really learned to live until I feared I was going to die. My dear Lucille Blake, you may not realize it, but you learned the same lesson that Dr. Samuel Johnson learned 200 years ago. The habit of looking on the best side of every event, said Dr. Johnson, is worth more than £1,000 a year. Those words were uttered, mind you, not by a professional optimist, but by a man who had known anxiety, rags, and hunger for 20 years, and finally became one of the most eminent writers of his generation and the most celebrated conversationalist of all time. Logan Pearsall Smith packed a lot of wisdom into a few words when he said, "There are two things to aim at in life. First, to get what you want, and after that, to enjoy it. Only the wisest of mankind achieve the second." Would you like to know how to make even dishwashing at the kitchen sink a thrilling experience? If so, read an inspiring book of incredible courage by Borghild Dahl. It is called I Wanted to See. This book was written by a woman who was practically blind for half a century. "I had only one eye," she writes, "and it was so covered with dense scars that I had to do all my seeing through one small opening in the left of the eye. I could see a book only by holding it up close to my face and by straining my one eye as hard as I could to the left." But she refused to be pitied, refused to be considered different. As a child, she wanted to play hopscotch with other children, but she couldn't see the markings. So after the other children had gone home, she got down on the ground and crawled along with her eyes near to the marks. She memorized every bit of the ground where she and her friends played and soon became an expert at running games. She did her reading at home, holding a book of large print so close to her eyes that her eyelashes brushed the pages. She earned 2 college degrees, an A.B. from the University of Minnesota and a Master of Arts from Columbia University. She started teaching in the tiny village of Twin Valley, Minnesota, and rose until she became Professor of Journalism and Literature at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. She taught there for 13 years, lecturing before women's clubs and giving radio talks about books and authors. "In the back of my mind," she writes, "there had always lurked a fear of total blindness. In order to overcome this, I had adopted a cheerful, almost hilarious attitude toward life." Then in 1943, when she was 52 years old, a miracle happened, an operation at the famous Mayo Clinic. She could now see 40 times as well as she had ever been able to see before. A new and exciting world of loveliness opened before her. She now found it thrilling even to wash dishes in the kitchen sink. "I began to play with the white fluffy suds in the dishpan," she writes. "I dip my hands into them, and I pick up a ball of tiny soap bubbles. I hold them up against the light, and in each of them I can see brilliant colors of a miniature rainbow." As she looked through the windows above the kitchen sink, she saw the flapping gray-black wings of the sparrows flying through the thick, falling snow. She found such ecstasy looking at the soap bubbles and sparrows that she closed her book with these words, "Dear Lord, I whisper, Our Father in heaven, I thank Thee. I thank Thee." Imagine thanking God because you can wash dishes and see rainbows and bubbles and sparrows flying through the snow. You and I ought to be ashamed of ourselves. All the days of our years we have been living in a fairyland of beauty, but we have been too blind to see, too satiated to enjoy. If we want to stop worrying and start living, rule 4 is, count your blessings, not your troubles. Chapter 16. Find yourself and be yourself. Remember, there is no one else on earth like you. I have a letter from Mrs. Edith Allred of Mount Airy, North Carolina. As a child, I was extremely sensitive and shy, she says in her letter. I was always overweight, and my cheeks made me look even fatter than I was. I had an old-fashioned mother who thought it was foolish to make clothes look pretty. She always said, "Wide will wear, while narrow will tear," and she dressed me accordingly. I never went to parties, never had any fun, and when I went to school, I never joined the other children in outside activities, not even athletics. I was morbidly shy. I felt I was different from everybody else, and entirely undesirable. When I grew up, I married a man who was several years my senior, but I didn't change. My in-laws were a poised and self-confident family. They were everything I should have been, but simply was not. I tried my best to be like them, but I couldn't. Every attempt they made to draw me out of myself only drove me further into my shell. I became nervous and irritable. I avoided all friends. I got so bad, I even dreaded the sound of the doorbell ringing. I was a failure, I knew it, and I was afraid my husband would find out. So whenever we were in public, I tried to be gay and overacted my part. I knew I overacted, and I would be miserable for days afterward. At last, I became so unhappy that I could see no point in prolonging my existence. I began to think of suicide. What happened to change this unhappy woman's life? Just a chance remark. A chance remark, Mrs. Allred continued, transformed my whole life. My mother-in-law was talking one day of how she brought her children up, and she said, "No matter what happened, I always insisted on their being themselves." On being themselves. That remark is what did it. In a flash, I realized I had brought all this misery on myself by trying to fit myself into a pattern to which I did not conform. I changed overnight. I started being myself. I tried to make a study of my own personality, tried to find out what I was. I studied my strong points. I learned all I could about colors and styles and dressed in a way that I felt was becoming to me. I reached out to make friends. I joined an organization, a small one at first, and was petrified with fright when they put me on a program. But each time I spoke, I gained a little courage. It took a long while. But today I have more happiness than I ever dreamed possible. In rearing my own children, I have always taught them the lesson I had to learn from such bitter experience. No matter what happens, always be yourself. This problem of being willing to be yourself is as old as history, says Dr. James Gordon Gilkey, and as universal as human life. This problem of being unwilling to be yourself is the hidden spring behind many neuroses and psychoses and complexes. Angelo Patri has written 13 books and thousands of syndicated newspaper articles on the subject of child training. And he says, "Nobody is so miserable as he who longs to be somebody and something other than the person he is in body and mind." This craving to be something you are not is especially rampant in Hollywood. Sam Wood, one of Hollywood's best-known directors, said the greatest headache he has with aspiring young actors is exactly this problem, to make them be themselves. They all want to be second-rate Lana Turners or third-rate Clark Gables. The public has already had that flavor, Sam Wood keeps telling them. Now it wants something else. Before he started directing such pictures as Goodbye, Mr. Chips and For Whom the Bell Tolls, Sam Wood spent years in the real estate business, developing sales personalities. He declares that the same principles apply in the business world as in the world of moving pictures. You won't get anywhere playing the ape. You can't be a parrot. Experience has taught me, says Sam Wood, that it's the safest to drop as quickly as possible people who pretend to be what they aren't. I asked Paul Boynton, then employment director for a major oil company, what's the biggest mistake people make in applying for jobs. He ought to know. He has interviewed more than 60,000 job seekers, and he's written a book entitled Six Ways to Get a Job. He replied, "The biggest mistake people make in applying for jobs is in not being themselves. Instead of taking their hair down and being completely frank, they often try to give you the answer they think you want. But it doesn't work because nobody wants a phony. Nobody ever wants a counterfeit coin." A certain daughter of a streetcar conductor had to learn that lesson the hard way. She longed to be a singer, but her face was her misfortune. She had a large mouth and protruding buck teeth. When she first sang in public, in a New Jersey nightclub, she tried to pull down her upper lip to cover her teeth. She tried to act glamorous. The results? She made herself ridiculous. She was headed for failure. However, there was a man in this nightclub who heard the girl sing and thought she had talent. "See here," he said bluntly, "I've been watching your performance, and I know what it is you're trying to hide. You're ashamed of your teeth." The girl was embarrassed, but the man continued, "What of it? Is there any particular crime in having buck teeth? Don't try to hide them. Open your mouth, and the audience will love you when they see you're not ashamed. Besides," he said shrewdly, "those teeth you're trying to hide may make your fortune." Cass Daly took his advice and forgot about her teeth. From that time on, she thought only about her audience. She opened her mouth wide and sang with such gusto and enjoyment that she became a top star in movies and radio. Other comedians tried to copy her. The renowned William James was speaking of people who had never found themselves when he declared that the average person develops only 10% of his or her latent mental abilities. "Compared to what we ought to be," he wrote, "we are only half awake. We are making use of only a small part of our physical and mental resources." Stating the thing broadly, human individuals thus live far within their limits. They possess powers of various sorts which they habitually fail to use. You and I have such abilities, so let's not waste a second worrying because we're not like other people. You are something new in this world. Never before, since the beginning of time, has there ever been anybody exactly like you. And never again, throughout all the ages to come, will there ever be anybody exactly like you again. The science of genetics informs us that you are what you are largely as a result of 23 chromosomes contributed by your father and 23 chromosomes contributed by your mother. These 46 chromosomes comprise everything that determines what you inherit. In each chromosome there may be, says Amram Scheinfeld, anywhere from scores to hundreds of genes, with a single gene, in some cases, able to change the whole life of an individual. Truly, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. Even after your mother and father met and mated, there was only one chance in 300,000 billion that the person who is specifically you would be born. In other words, if you had 300,000 billion brothers and sisters, they might all have been different from you. Is this all guesswork? No, it's a scientific fact. If you'd like to read more about it, consult You and Heredity by Amram Scheinfeld. I can talk with conviction about this subject of being yourself because I feel deeply about it. I know what I'm talking about. I know from bitter and costly experience. To illustrate, when I first came to New York from the cornfields of Missouri, I enrolled in the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. I aspired to be an actor. I had what I thought was a brilliant idea, a shortcut to success, an idea so simple, so foolproof that I couldn't understand why thousands of ambitious people hadn't already discovered it. It was this. I would study how the famous actors of that day, John Drew, Walter Hamden, and Otis Skinner, got their effects. Then I would imitate the best points of each one of them and make myself into a shining, triumphant combination of all of them. How silly! How absurd! I had to waste years of my life imitating other people before it penetrated through my thick Missouri skull that I had to be myself, that I couldn't possibly be anyone else. That distressing experience ought to have taught me a lasting lesson, but it didn't, not me. I was too dumb. I had to learn it all over again. Several years later, I set out to write what I hoped would be the best book on public speaking for businessmen that had ever been written. I had the same foolish idea about writing this book that I had formerly had about acting. I was going to borrow the ideas of a lot of other writers and put them all in one book, a book that would have everything. So I got scores of books on public speaking and spent a year incorporating their ideas into my manuscript. But it finally dawned on me once again that I was playing the fool. This hodgepodge of other men's ideas that I had written was so synthetic, so dull, that no businessman would ever plod through it. So I tossed a year's work into the wastebasket and started all over again. This time, I said to myself, you've got to be Dale Carnegie, with all his faults and limitations. You can't possibly be anybody else. So I quit trying to be a combination of other men and rolled up my sleeves and did what I should have done in the first place. I wrote a textbook on public speaking out of my own experiences, observations, and convictions as a speaker and a teacher of speaking. I learned for all time, I hope, the lesson that Sir Walter Raleigh learned. I'm not talking about the Sir Walter who threw his coat in the mud for the Queen to step on. I'm talking about the Sir Walter Raleigh who was professor of English literature at Oxford back in 1904. I can't write a book commensurate with Shakespeare, he said, but I can write a book by me. Be yourself. Act on the sage advice that Irving Berlin gave the late George Gershwin. When Berlin and Gershwin first met, Berlin was famous, but Gershwin was a struggling young composer working for $35 a week in Tin Pan Alley. Berlin, impressed by Gershwin's ability, offered Gershwin a job as his musical secretary at almost three times the salary he was then getting. But don't take the job, Berlin advised. If you do, you may develop into a second-rate Berlin. And if you insist on being yourself, someday you'll be a first-rate Gershwin. Gershwin heeded that warning and slowly transformed himself into one of the significant American composers of his generation. Charlie Chaplin, Will Rogers, Mary Margaret McBride, Gene Autry, millions of others had to learn the lesson I'm trying to hammer home in this chapter. They had to learn the hard way, just as I did. When Charlie Chaplin first started making films, the director of the picture insisted on Chaplin's imitating a popular German comedian of that day. Charlie Chaplin got nowhere until he acted himself. Bob Hope had a similar experience. He spent years in the singing and dancing act and got nowhere until he began to wisecrack and be himself. Will Rogers twirled a rope in vaudeville for years without saying a word. He got nowhere until he discovered his unique gift for humor and began to talk as he twirled his rope. When Mary Margaret McBride first went on the air, she tried to be an Irish comedian and failed. When she tried to be just what she was, a plain country girl from Missouri, she became one of the most popular radio stars in New York. When Gene Autry tried to get rid of his Texas accent and dressed like city boys and claimed he was from New York, people merely laughed behind his back. But when he started twanging his banjo and singing cowboy ballads, Gene Autry started out on a career that made him the world's most popular cowboy, both in pictures and on the radio. You are something new in this world. Be glad of it. Make the most of what nature gave you. In the last analysis, all art is autobiographical. You can sing only what you are. You can paint only what you are. You must be what your experiences, your environment, and your heredity have made you. For better or for worse, you must cultivate your own little garden. For better or for worse, you must play your own little instrument in the orchestra of life. As Emerson said in his essay on self-reliance, there is a time in every man's education when he arrives at the conviction that envy is ignorance, that imitation is suicide, that he must take himself, for better, for worse, as his portion, that though the wide universe is full of good, no kernel of nourishing corn can come to him but which his toil bestowed on that plot of ground which is given him to till. The power which resides in him is new in nature, and none but he knows what that is which he can do, nor does he know until he has tried. And that's the way Emerson said it. But here's the way a poet, the late Douglas Mallock, said it. If you can't be a pine on the top of the hill, be a scrub in the valley, but be the best little scrub by the side of the hill, be a bush if you can't be a tree. If you can't be a bush, be a bit of the grass, and some highway happier make. If you can't be a muskie, then just be a bass, but the liveliest bass in the lake. We can't all be captains, we've got to be crew. There's something for all of us here. There's big work to do, and there's lesser to do, and the task we must do is the near. If you can't be a highway, then just be a trail. If you can't be the sun, be a star. It isn't by size that you win or you fail. Be the best of whatever you are. To cultivate a mental attitude that will bring us peace and freedom from worry, here's Rule 5. Let's not imitate others. Let's find ourselves and be ourselves. Chapter 17. If you have a lemon, make a lemonade. While writing this book, I dropped in one day at the University of Chicago and asked the chancellor, Robert Maynard Hutchins, how he kept from worrying. He replied, "I've always tried to follow a bit of advice given to me by the late Julius Rosenwald, president of Sears Roebuck and Company. When you have a lemon, make a lemonade." That is what a great educator does. But the fool does the exact opposite. If he finds that life has handed him a lemon, he gives up and says, "I'm beaten. It is fate. I haven't got a chance." Then he proceeds to rail against the world and indulge in an orgy of self-pity. But when the wise man is handed a lemon, he says, "What lesson can I learn from this misfortune? How can I improve my situation? How can I turn this lemon into a lemonade?" After spending a lifetime studying people and their hidden reserves of power, the great psychologist Alfred Adler declared that one of the wonder-filled characteristics of human beings is their power to turn a minus into a plus. Here's an interesting and stimulating story of a woman I know who did just that. Her name is Thelma Thompson. "During the war," she said, as she told me of her experience, "during the war, my husband was stationed at an army training camp near the Mojave Desert in California. I went to live there in order to be near him. I hated the place. I loathed it. I had never before been so miserable. My husband was ordered out on maneuvers in the Mojave Desert, and I was left in a tiny shack alone. The heat was unbearable, 125 degrees in the shade of a cactus. Not a soul to talk to. The wind blew incessantly, and all the food I ate, the very air I breathed, were filled with sand, sand, sand. I was so utterly wretched, so sorry for myself, that I wrote to my parents. I told them I was giving up and coming back home. I said I couldn't stand it one minute longer. I would rather be in jail. My father answered my letter with just two lines that will always sing in my memory, two lines that completely altered my life. Two men looked out from prison bars. One saw the mud, the other saw the stars." I read those two lines over and over. I was ashamed of myself. I made up my mind I would find out what was good in my present situation. I would look for the stars. I made friends with the natives, and their reaction amazed me. When I showed interest in their weaving and pottery, they gave me presents of their favorite pieces, which they'd refused to sell to tourists. I studied the fascinating forms of the cactus and the yuccas and the Joshua trees. I learned about prairie dogs, watched for the desert sunsets, and hunted for seashells that had been left there millions of years ago when the sands of the desert had been an ocean floor. What brought about this astonishing change in me? The Mojave Desert hadn't changed, but I had. I had changed my attitude of mind, and by doing so, I'd transformed a wretched experience into the most exciting adventure of my life. I was stimulated and excited by this new world that I'd discovered. I was so excited, I wrote a book about it, a novel that was published under the title Bright Ramparts. I had looked out of my self-created prison and found the stars. Thelma Thompson, you discovered an old truth that the Greeks taught 500 years before Christ was born. The best things are the most difficult. Harry Emerson Fosdick repeated it again in the 20th century. "Happiness is not mostly pleasure, it is mostly victory." Yes, the victory that comes from a sense of achievement, of triumph, of turning our lemons into lemonades. I once visited a happy farmer down in Florida who turned even a poison lemon into lemonade. When he first got his farm, he was discouraged. The land was so wretched he could neither grow fruit nor raise pigs. Nothing thrived there but scrub oaks and rattlesnakes. Then he got his idea. He would turn his liability into an asset. he would make the most of these rattlesnakes. To everyone's amazement, he started canning rattlesnake meat. When I stopped to visit him a few years ago, I found that tourists were pouring in to see his rattlesnake farm at the rate of 20,000 a year. His business was thriving. I saw poison from the fangs of his rattlers being shipped to laboratories to make anti-venom toxin. I saw rattlesnake skins being sold at fancy prices to make women's shoes and handbags. I saw canned rattlesnake meat being shipped to customers all over the world. I bought a picture postcard of the place and mailed it at the local post office of the village, which had been rechristened Rattlesnake, Florida, in honor of a man who had turned a poison lemon into a sweet lemonade. As I've traveled up and down and back and forth across this nation time after time, it has been my privilege to meet dozens of men and women who have demonstrated their power to turn a minus into a plus. The late William Bolitho, author of 12 Against the Gods, put it like this: "The most important thing in life is not to capitalize on your gains. Any fool can do that. The really important thing is to profit from your losses. That requires intelligence, and it makes the difference between a man of sense and a fool." Bolitho uttered those words after he had lost a leg in a railway accident. But I know a man who lost both legs and turned his minus into a plus. His name is Ben Fortson. I met him in a hotel elevator in Atlanta, Georgia. As I stepped into the elevator, I noticed this cheerful-looking man who had both legs missing sitting in a wheelchair in a corner of the elevator. When the elevator stopped at his floor, he asked me pleasantly if I would step to one corner so he could manage his chair better. "So sorry," he said, "to inconvenience you," and a deep, heartwarming smile lighted his face as he said it. When I left the elevator and went to my room, I could think of nothing but this cheerful cripple, so I hunted him up and asked him to tell me his story. "It happened in 1929," he told me with a smile. "I'd gone out to cut a load of hickory poles to stake the beans in my garden. I had loaded the poles onto my Ford and started back home. Suddenly, one pole slipped under the car and jammed the steering apparatus at the very moment I was making a sharp turn. The car shot over an embankment and hurled me against a tree. My spine was hurt. My legs were paralyzed. I was 24 when that happened, and I've never taken a step since." 24 years old and sentenced to a wheelchair for the rest of his life. I asked him how he managed to take it so courageously, and he said, "I didn't." He said he raged and rebelled. He fumed about his fate. But as the years dragged on, he found that his rebellion wasn't getting him anything except bitterness. "I finally realized," he said, "that other people were kind and courteous to me, so the least I could do was be kind and courteous to them." I asked if he still felt, after all these years, that his accident had been a terrible misfortune, and he promptly said no. He said, "I'm almost glad now that it happened." He told me that after he got over the shock and resentment, he began to live in a different world. He began to read and developed a love for good literature. In 14 years, he said, he had read at least 1,400 books, and those books had opened up new horizons for him and made his life richer than he had ever thought possible. He began to listen to good music, and he's now thrilled by great symphonies that would have bored him before. But the biggest change was that he had time to think. "For the first time in my life," he said, "I was able to look at the world and get a real sense of values. I began to realize that most of the things I'd been striving for before weren't worthwhile at all." As a result of his reading, he became interested in politics, studied public questions, made speeches from his wheelchair. He got to know people, and people got to know him, and still in his wheelchair, he got to be Secretary of State for the state of Georgia. While conducting adult education classes in New York City, I've discovered that one of the major regrets of many adults is that they never went to college. They seem to think that not having a college education is a great handicap. I know that this isn't necessarily true because I've known thousands of successful men who never went beyond high school. So I often tell these students the story of a man I knew who had never finished even grade school. He was brought up in blighting poverty. When his father died, his father's friends had to chip in to pay for the coffin in which he was buried. After his father's death, his mother worked in an umbrella factory 10 hours a day and then brought piecework home and worked until 11 o'clock at night. The boy, brought up in these circumstances, went in for amateur dramatics, put on by a club in his church. He got such a thrill out of acting that he decided to take up public speaking. This led him into politics. By the time he reached 30, he was elected to the New York State Legislature. But he was woefully unprepared for such a responsibility. In fact, he told me that, frankly, he didn't know what it was all about. He studied the long, complicated bills that he was supposed to vote on, but as far as he was concerned, those bills might as well have been written in the language of the Choctaw Indians. He was worried and bewildered when he was made a member of the Committee on Forests before he'd ever set foot in a forest. He was worried and bewildered when he was made a member of the State Banking Commission before he had ever had a bank account. He himself told me that he was so discouraged that he would have resigned from the legislature if he hadn't been ashamed to admit defeat to his mother. In despair, he decided to study 16 hours a day and turn his lemon of ignorance into a lemonade of knowledge. By doing that, he transformed himself from a local politician into a national figure and made himself so outstanding that the New York Times called him the best-loved citizen of New York. I'm talking about Al Smith. 10 years after Al Smith set out on his program of political self-education, he was the greatest living authority on the government of New York State. He was elected governor of New York for 4 terms, at that time a record never attained by any other man. In 1928, he was the Democratic candidate for president. 6 great universities, including Columbia and Harvard, conferred honorary degrees upon this man who had never gone beyond grade school. Al Smith himself told me that none of these things would ever have come to pass if he hadn't worked hard 16 hours a day to turn his minus into a plus. Nietzsche's formula for the superior man was not only to bear up under necessity, but to live it. The more I've studied the careers of men of achievement, the more deeply I've been convinced that surprisingly large numbers of them succeeded because they started out with handicaps that spurred them on to greater endeavor and greater rewards. As William James said, "Our very infirmities help us unexpectedly." Yes, it's highly probable that Milton wrote better poetry because he was blind, and that Beethoven composed better music because he was deaf. Helen Keller's brilliant career was inspired and made possible because of her blindness and deafness. If Tchaikovsky had not been frustrated and driven almost to suicide by his tragic marriage, if his own life had not been pathetic, he probably would never have been able to compose his immortal Symphonie Pathétique. If Dostoevsky and Tolstoy had not led tortured lives, they would probably never have been able to write their immortal novels. "If I had not been so great an invalid," wrote the man who changed the scientific concept of life on Earth, "if I had not been so great an invalid, I should not have done so much work as I have accomplished." And that was Charles Darwin's confession that his infirmities had helped him unexpectedly. The same day that Darwin was born in England, another baby was born in a log cabin in the forests of Kentucky. He, too, was helped by his infirmities. His name was Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln. If he had been reared in an aristocratic family and had had a law degree from Harvard and a happy married life, he would probably never have found in the depths of his heart the haunting words that he immortalized at Gettysburg, nor the sacred poem that he spoke at his second inauguration, the most beautiful and noble phrases ever uttered by a ruler of men, "with malice toward none, with charity for all." Harry Emerson Fosdick says in his book, The Power to See It Through, "There is a Scandinavian saying which some of us might well take as a rallying cry for our lives. The North Wind made the Vikings." Wherever did we get the idea that secure and pleasant living, the absence of difficulty and the comfort of ease, ever of themselves made people either good or happy? Upon the contrary, people who pity themselves go on pitying themselves even when they are laid softly on a cushion. But always in history, character and happiness have come to people in all sorts of circumstances, good, bad, and indifferent, when they shouldered their personal responsibility. So repeatedly, the North Wind has made the Vikings. Suppose we're so discouraged that we feel there's no hope of our ever being able to turn our lemons into lemonade. Then here are two reasons why we ought to try, anyway. Two reasons why we have everything to gain and nothing to lose. Reason one, we may succeed. Reason two, even if we don't succeed, the mere attempt to turn our minus into a plus will cause us to look forward instead of backward. It will replace negative thoughts with positive thoughts. It will release creative energy and spur us to get so busy that we won't have either the time or the inclination to mourn over what is past and forever gone. Once when Ole Bull, the world-famous violinist, was giving a concert in Paris, the A string on his violin suddenly snapped. But Ole Bull simply finished the melody on three strings. "That is life," says Harry Emerson Fosdick, "to have your A string snap and finish on three strings." That is not only life, it is more than life, it is life triumphant. If I had the power to do so, I would have these words of William Bolitho carved in eternal bronze and hung in every schoolhouse in the land. The most important thing in life is not to capitalize on your gains. Any fool can do that. The really important thing is to profit from your losses. That requires intelligence, and it makes the difference between a man of sense and a fool. So to cultivate a mental attitude that will bring us peace and happiness, let's do something about Rule 6. When fate hands us a lemon, let's try to make a lemonade. Chapter 18. How to Cure Depression in 14 Days. When I started writing this book, I offered a $200 prize for the most helpful and inspiring true story on how I conquered worry. The three judges for this contest were Eddie Rickenbacker, President, Eastern Airlines, Dr. Stuart W. McClelland, President, Lincoln Memorial University, H.B. Kaltenborn, radio news analyst. However, we received two stories so superb that the judges found it impossible to choose between them. So we divided the prize. Here's one of the stories that tied for first prize. The story of C.R. Burton, who worked for Whizzer Motor Sales of Springfield, Missouri. "I lost my mother when I was 9 years old and my father when I was 12," Mr. Burton wrote me. "My father was killed, but my mother simply walked out of the house one day 19 years ago, and I've never seen her since. Neither have I ever seen my two little sisters that she took with her. She never even wrote me a letter until after she'd been gone 7 years. My father was killed in an accident 3 years after Mother left. He and a partner had bought a cafe in a small Missouri town, and while Father was away on a business trip, his partner sold the cafe for cash and skipped out. A friend wired Father to hurry back home, and in his hurry, Father was killed in a car accident at Salinas, Kansas. Two of my father's sisters, who were poor and old and sick, took three of the children into their homes, and nobody wanted me and my little brother. We were left at the mercy of the town. We were haunted by the fear of being called orphans and treated as orphans. Our fears soon materialized, too. I lived for a little while with a poor family in town, but times were hard, and the head of the family lost his job, so they couldn't afford to feed me any longer. Then Mr. and Mrs. Lofton took me to live with them on their farm 11 miles from town. Mr. Lofton was 70 years old and sick in bed with shingles. He told me I could stay there as long as I didn't lie, didn't steal, and did as I was told. Those three orders became my Bible. I lived by them strictly. I started to school, but the first week found me at home bawling like a baby. The other children picked on me and poked fun at my big nose and said I was dumb and called me an orphan brat. I was hurt so badly that I wanted to fight them, but Mr. Lofton, the farmer who'd taken me in, said to me, 'Always remember that it takes a bigger man to walk away from a fight than it does to stay and fight.' I didn't fight until one day a kid picked up some chicken manure from the schoolhouse yard and threw it in my face. I beat the hell out of him and made a couple of friends. They said he had it coming to him. I was proud of a new cap that Mrs. Lofton had bought me. One day one of the big girls jerked it off my head and filled it with water and ruined it. She said she filled it with water so the water would wet my thick skull and keep my popcorn brains from popping. I never cried at school, but I used to bawl it out at home. Then one day Mrs. Lofton gave me some advice that did away with all troubles and worries and turned my enemies into friends. She said, "Ralph, they won't tease you and call you an orphan brat any more if you'll get interested in them and see how much you can do for them." I took her advice. I studied hard, and though I soon headed the class, I was never envied because I went out of my way to help them. I helped several of the boys write their themes and essays. I wrote complete debates for some of the boys. One lad was ashamed to let his folks know that I was helping him, so he used to tell his mother he was going possum hunting. And he'd come up to Mr. Lofton's and tie his dogs up in the barn while I helped him with his lessons. I wrote book reviews for one lad, and I spent several evenings helping one of the girls on her math. Death struck our neighborhood. Two elderly farmers died, and one woman was deserted by her husband. I was the only male in four families. I helped these widows for 2 years. On my way to and from school, I stopped at their farms, cut wood for them, milked their cows, and fed and watered their stock. I was now blessed instead of cursed. I was accepted as a friend by everyone. They showed me their real feelings when I returned home from the Navy. More than 200 farmers came to see me the first day I was home. Some of them drove as far as 80 miles, and their concern for me was really sincere. Because I've been busy and happy trying to help other people, I have few worries, and I haven't been called an orphan brat now for 13 years. Hooray for C.R. Burton. He knows how to win friends, and he also knows how to conquer worry and enjoy life. So did the late Dr. Frank Loop of Seattle, Washington. He was an invalid for 23 years, arthritis. Yet Stuart Whithouse of the Seattle Star wrote me saying, "I interviewed Dr. Loop many times, and I have never known a man more unselfish or a man who got more out of life." How did this bedridden invalid get so much out of life? I'll give you two guesses. Did he do it by complaining and criticizing? No. By wallowing in self-pity and demanding that he be the center of attention and everyone cater to him? No. Still wrong. He did it by adopting as his slogan the motto of the Prince of Wales, "Ich dien, I serve." He accumulated the names and addresses of other invalids and cheered both them and himself by writing happy, encouraging letters. In fact, he organized a letter-writing club for invalids and got them writing letters to one another. Finally, he formed a national organization called the Shut-In Society. As he lay in bed, he wrote an average of 1,400 letters a year and brought joy to thousands of invalids by getting radios and books for shut-ins. What was the chief difference between Dr. Loop and a lot of other people? Just this. Dr. Loop had the inner glow of a man with a purpose, a mission. He had the joy of knowing that he was being used by an idea far nobler and more significant than himself, instead of being, as Shaw put it, a self-centered little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world would not devote itself to making him happy. Here's the most astonishing statement that I ever read from the pen of a great psychiatrist. This statement was made by Alfred Adler. He used to say to his melancholia patients, "You can be cured in 14 days if you follow this prescription. Try to think every day how you can please someone." That statement sounds so incredible that I feel I ought to try to explain it by quoting a couple of pages from Dr. Adler's splendid book, What Life Should Mean to You. Melancholia is like a long-continued rage and reproach against others. Though for the purpose of gaining care, sympathy, and support, the patient seems only to be dejected about his own guilt. A melancholiac's first memory is generally something like this. "I can remember I wanted to lie on the couch, but my brother was lying there. I cried so much that he had to leave." Melancholiacs are often inclined to revenge themselves by committing suicide. and the doctor's first care is to avoid giving them an excuse for suicide. I myself try to relieve the whole tension by proposing to them as the first rule of treatment, never do anything you don't like. This seems to be very modest, but I believe that it goes right to the root of the whole trouble. If a melancholiac is able to do anything he wants, whom can he accuse? What has he got to revenge himself for? If you want to go to the theater, I tell him, or go on a holiday, do it. If you find on the way that you don't want to, stop it. It's the best situation anyone could be in. It gives a satisfaction to his striving for superiority. He is like God and can do what he pleases. On the other hand, it does not fit very easily into his style of life. He wants to dominate and accuse others, and if they agree with him, there is no way of dominating them. This rule is a great relief, and I have never had a suicide among my patients. Generally, the patient replies, "But there is nothing I like doing. I have prepared for this answer because I have heard it so often." "Then refrain from doing anything you dislike," I say. Sometimes, however, he will reply, "I should like to stay in bed all day." I know that if I allow it, he will no longer want to do it. I know that if I hinder him, he will start a war. I always agree. This is one rule. Another attacks their style of life still more directly. I tell them, "You can be cured in 14 days if you follow this prescription. Try to think every day how you can please someone." See what this means to them. They are occupied with the thought, "How can I worry someone?" Their answers are very interesting. Some say, "Oh, this will be very easy for me. I have done it all my life." They have never done it. I ask them to think it over. They do not think it over. I tell them, "You can make use of all the time you spend when you are unable to go to sleep by thinking how you can please someone, and it will be a big step forward in your health." When I see them the next day, I ask them, "Did you think over what I suggested?" They answer, "Last night I went to sleep as soon as I got into bed." All this must be done, of course, in a modest, friendly manner, without a hint of superiority. Others will answer, "I could never do it. I was so worried." I tell them, "Don't stop worrying, but at the same time you can think now and then of others." I want to direct their interest always toward their fellows. Many say, "Why should I please others?" "Others do not try to please me. You must think of your health," I answer. "The others will suffer later on." It's extremely rare that I have found a patient who said, "I have thought over what you suggested. All my efforts are devoted toward increasing the social interest of the patient." I know that the real reason for his malady is his lack of cooperation, and I want him to see it too. As soon as he can connect himself with his fellow men on an equal and cooperative footing, he is cured. The most important task imposed by religion has always been love thy neighbor. It is the individual who is not interested in his fellow man who has the greatest difficulties in life and provides the greatest injury to others. It is from among such individuals that all human failures spring. All that we demand of a human being, and the highest praise we can give him, is that he should be a good fellow worker, a friend to all other men, and a true partner in love and marriage. Dr. Adler urges us to do a good deed every day. And what is a good deed? A good deed, said the Prophet Muhammad, is one that brings a smile of joy to the face of another. Why will doing a good deed every day produce such astounding effects on the doer? Because trying to please others will cause us to stop thinking of ourselves, the very thing that produces worry and fear and melancholia. Mrs. William T. Moon, who operated the Moon Secretarial School in New York, didn't have to spend 2 weeks thinking how she could please someone in order to banish her melancholy. She went Alfred Adler one better. No, she did Adler 13 better. She banished her melancholy not in 14 days, but in one day, by thinking how she could please a couple of orphans. It happened like this. "In December, 5 years ago," said Mrs. Moon, "I was engulfed in the feeling of sorrow and self-pity. After several years of happy married life, I had lost my husband. As the Christmas holidays approached, my sadness deepened. I'd never spent a Christmas alone in all my life, and I dreaded to see this Christmas come. Friends had invited me to spend Christmas with them, but I did not feel up to any gaiety. I knew I would be a wet blanket at any party, so I refused their kind invitations. As Christmas Eve approached, I was more and more overwhelmed with self-pity. True, I should have been thankful for many things, as all of us have many things for which to be thankful. The day before Christmas, I left my office at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and started walking aimlessly up Fifth Avenue, hoping that I might banish my self-pity and melancholy. The avenue was jammed with gay and happy crowds, scenes that brought back memories of happy years that were gone. I just couldn't bear the thought of going home to a lonely, empty apartment. I was bewildered. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't keep the tears back. After walking aimlessly for an hour or so, I found myself in front of a bus terminal. I remembered that my husband and I had often boarded an unknown bus for adventure, so I boarded the first bus I found at the station. After crossing the Hudson River and riding for some time, I heard the bus conductor say, "Last stop, lady." I got off. I didn't even know the name of the town. It was a quiet, peaceful little place. While waiting for the next bus home, I started walking up a residential street. As I passed a church, I heard the beautiful strains of Silent Night. I went in. The church was empty, except for the organist. I sat down, unnoticed, in one of the pews. The lights from the gaily decorated Christmas tree made the decoration seem like myriads of stars dancing in the moonbeams. The long-drawn cadences of the music and the fact that I had forgotten to eat since morning made me drowsy. I was weary and heavy-laden, so I drifted off to sleep. When I awoke, I didn't know where I was. I was terrified. I saw in front of me two small children who had apparently come in to see the Christmas tree. One, a little girl, was pointing at me, saying, "I wonder if Santa Claus brought her." These children were also frightened when I awoke. I told them that I wouldn't hurt them. They were poorly dressed. I asked them where their mother and daddy were. "We ain't got no mother and daddy," they said. Here were two little orphans, much worse off than I had ever been. They made me feel ashamed of my sorrow and self-pity. I showed them the Christmas tree, and then took them to a drugstore, and we had some refreshments, and I bought them some candy and a few presents. My loneliness vanished as if by magic. These two orphans gave me the only real happiness and self-forgetfulness that I had had in months. As I chatted with them, I realized how lucky I had been. I thanked God that all my Christmases as a child had been bright with parental love and tenderness. Those two little orphans did far more for me than I did for them. That experience showed me again the necessity of making other people happy in order to be happy ourselves. I found that happiness is contagious. By giving, we receive. By helping someone and giving out love, I had conquered worry and sorrow and self-pity and felt like a new person. And I was a new person, not only then, but in the years that followed. I could fill a book with stories of people who forgot themselves into health and happiness. For example, let's take the case of Margaret Taylor Yates, one of the most popular women in the United States Navy. Now, Mrs. Yates is a writer of novels, but none of her mystery stories is half so interesting as the true story of what happened to her that fateful morning when the Japanese struck our fleet at Pearl Harbor. Mrs. Yates had been an invalid for more than a year, a bad heart. She spent 22 out of every 24 hours in bed. The longest journey that she undertook was a walk into the garden to take a sunbath. Even then, she had to lean on the maid's arm as she walked. She herself told me that in those days she expected to be an invalid for the rest of her life. "I would never have really lived again," she told me, "if the Japanese had not struck Pearl Harbor and jarred me out of my complacency." When this happened, Mrs. Yates said as she told her story, "Everything was chaos and confusion. One bomb struck so near my home the concussion threw me out of bed. Army trucks rushed out to Hickam Field, Schofield Barracks, and Kaneohe Bay Air Station to bring Army and Navy wives and children to the public schools. There, the Red Cross telephoned those who had extra rooms to take them in. The Red Cross workers knew that I had a telephone beside my bed, so they asked me to be a clearinghouse of information. So I kept track of where Army and Navy wives and children were being housed, and all Navy and Army men were instructed by the Red Cross to telephone me to find out where their families were. I soon discovered that my husband, Commander Robert Raleigh Yates, was safe. I tried to cheer up the wives who did not know whether their husbands had been killed. I tried to give consolation to the widows whose husbands had been killed, and there were many. 2,117 officers and enlisted men in the Navy and Marine Corps were killed, and 960 were reported missing. At first, I answered these phone calls while lying in bed. Then I answered them sitting up in bed. Finally, I got so busy, so excited, that I forgot all about my weakness and got out of bed and sat by a table. By helping others, who were much worse off than I was, I forgot all about myself, and I have never gone back to bed again, except for my regular 8 hours of sleep each night. I realize now that if the Japanese had not struck at Pearl Harbor, I would probably have remained a semi-invalid all my life. I was comfortable in bed, I was constantly waited on, and I now realize that I was unconsciously losing my will to rehabilitate myself. The attack on Pearl Harbor was one of the greatest tragedies in American history, but as far as I was concerned, it was one of the best things that ever happened to me. That terrible crisis gave me strength that I never dreamed I possessed. It took my attention off myself and focused it on others. It gave me something big and vital and important to live for. I no longer had time to think about myself or care about myself. A third of the people who rushed to psychiatrists for help could probably cure themselves if they could only do as Margaret Yates did, get interested in helping others. My idea? No, that's approximately what Carl Jung said, and he ought to know if anybody does. He said, about one-third of my patients are suffering from no clinically definable neurosis, but from the senselessness and emptiness of their lives. And to put it another way, they're trying to thumb a ride through life, and the parade passes them by. So they rush to a psychiatrist with their petty, senseless, useless lives. Having missed the boat, they stand on the wharf, blaming everyone except themselves and demanding that the world cater to their self-centered desires. You may be saying to yourself now, well, I'm not impressed by these stories. I myself could get interested in a couple of orphans I met on Christmas Eve, and if I'd been at Pearl Harbor, I would gladly have done what Margaret Taylor Yates did. But with me, things are different. I live an ordinary, humdrum life. I work at a dull job 8 hours a day. Nothing dramatic ever happens to me. How can I get interested in helping others? And why should I? What is there in it for me? A fair question. I'll try to answer it. However humdrum your existence may be, you surely meet some people every day of your life. And what do you do about them? Do you merely stare through them, or do you try to find out what it is that makes them tick? How about the postman, for example? He travels hundreds of miles every year delivering your mail, but have you ever taken the trouble to find out where he lives, or asked to see a snapshot of his wife and his kids? Did you ever ask him if he gets tired, or if he ever gets bored? What about the grocery boy, the newspaper vendor, the chap at the corner who polishes your shoes? These people are human, bursting with troubles and dreams and private ambitions. They're also bursting for the chance to share them with someone. But do you ever let them? Do you ever show an eager, honest interest in them or their lives? That's the sort of thing I mean. You don't have to become a Florence Nightingale or a social reformer to help improve the world, your own private world. You can start tomorrow morning with the people you meet. What's in it for you? Much greater happiness, greater satisfaction, and pride in yourself. Aristotle called this kind of attitude enlightened selfishness. Zoroaster said, doing good for others is not a duty, it is a joy, for it increases your own health and happiness. And Benjamin Franklin summed it up very simply. When you're good to others, said Franklin, you are best to yourself. No discovery of modern psychology, wrote Henry C. Link, director of the Psychological Service Center in New York, is, in my opinion, so important as its scientific proof of the necessity of self-sacrifice or discipline to self-realization and happiness.